Novel coronavirus all day, right here on The Uprising.
LibertyNation.com. They're the resistance, but we are The Uprising with Scott Cosenza.
I felt this thrill going up my leg.
There's not going to be a President Donald Trump.
A president! Can you believe it?
This is somebody who knows what's right and what's wrong.
You know what podcasts are, by the way?
Talk shows for people who cannot make it in talk radio.
I just want to say to the men of this country, just shut up, do the right thing. Watch it.
I think possibly that's the most unattractive form in which prejudice can be met in this country, is the rage of the entitled.
Welcome back to The Uprising, a podcast of LibertyNation.com. This is Scott DeCosenza, joined by Timothy Elting Donner from Studio C in parts unknown again, sequestering himself from the national capital area coronavirus outbreak.
Yes, it works well, Scott, because I'm self-quarantining, which is now a very trendy thing.
And Archie the podcasting dog, who is somewhat trepidatious because the canine coronavirus information has not really been front and center, but
it we haven't been able to drill down to the bottom of the whole thing about dogs and the coronavirus. Have we ruled out the possibility that a dog could be a carrier? It's supposed to be snake. That's the current thinking, correct?
I don't know what you mean.
That the virus initiated in a snake.
Oh, I thought it was bats.
Bats.
In fact,
before
an
that.
Uprising
yeah,
listener,
bats.
Tim, told me that it was bats that caused this problem.
And bats apparently were sort of ground zero, and then it went through snakes, I believe. I could be wrong with it, but the genesis was bats.
You know, Tim, right from the Bible, the snake's been getting a bad rap. I don't know if I believe
I know,
it, but
no, you know, you're
we
right.
started this
you're right.
podcast.
You're right.
it's a blood libel against the entire species.
That's really good.
We started this podcast at 4:20 p.m. on Friday, and I say that as a timestamp. Don't read anything into the hour there, but just in terms of this story, to say that this story is fast breaking and evolving is an understatement of the century. Trump just gave his state of emergency speech. This sort of brings together a lot of parts of my political identity with something that Trump said at the outset of his speech, declaring a state of emergency.
The emergency orders I'm issuing today will also confer broad new authority to the Secretary of Health and Human Services. The Secretary of HHS will be able to immediately waive provisions of applicable laws and regulations to give doctors, all hospitals and healthcare providers maximum flexibility to respond to the virus and care for patients. This includes the following critical authorities: the ability to waive laws to enable telehealth, a fairly new and incredible thing that's happened in the not so distant past. I tell you, what they've done with telehealth is incredible.
Why is it, Tim, that we have so many regulations that have to be knocked down for these healthcare providers to provide healthcare? What is the purpose of requiring government permission slips for the actual scientists, who, by the way, are almost all universally hyper-regulated already, right? They have licenses to practice medicine, for instance, licenses to operate hospitals, to then have to undergo more licensing by some bureaucrat in order to allow these things. It seems like it's insanity to me. And, you know, I've been focusing on the government response and whether or not Trump has sort of done a good job with this. And it seems like, you know, the imposition of government on the system is a failure already. And if people were free to do what they wanted to do, if the market was free, we'd already have a better response if market was allowed.
You know, there are some instances where you have to make exceptions to your overall ideology when something like a virus breaks out and you don't know how bad it is, how long it's going to last, how big an impact it's going to have, mostly because of the uncertainty, not because of a certainty that it's as deadly as many people fear, but because of the unknown. It's the fear of the unknown. And in those kind of circumstances, Scott, I think it is important that people know that the government has a plan. Now, it may not be the right plan. Could be a bad plan. But people want to know that they have some kind of plan in place that makes people feel safer. So it's hard to look at the issue you're talking about right now in this context because we see what's happened in countries like Italy.
Yeah, I want to stop you because I don't think you are responding to my...
Well, you're making the point that why is it that the government has to do all of this and that the private sector should be doing it and they could do it better.
Well, no, the point I was...
Did I misinterpret?
Point is that we're part of the reason why we're here today, Tim, is because of the regulations that were already in place that forbade, for instance, a hospital from doing their own testing without a signed waiver from the government. That's why we're here. So people are criticizing Trump for not allowing some other testing mechanism. Well, why does the government have to allow a testing mechanism for some hospital in Washington State? They're the scientists. Why aren't they allowed to just do testing as they see fit?
Okay, I see the point you're making.
Yeah.
You're saying, why should it even be necessary for these kind of measures to have to be taken? Why should we, for example, have to declare a national emergency and flood all these states with federal funds in order that they can, you know, break regulations in for an emergency? You know, it seems to me that your point is well taken. Unfortunately, it does take about two or three steps of thinking, doesn't it, at this point?
Well, that's the
to
sad
think of it that way.
There's a kind of analogy there with guns, Tim, and we're not going to talk about guns today, just to keep it clean on coronavirus. But when we talk about the next week, Tim, when we get into Joe Biden and the AR-14s, we can talk about how he says that the reason why they were able to get the assault weapons ban passed in part is because of it included the Violence Against Women Act. And nobody wants to be seen voting against the Violence Against Women Act, right? No matter what's in it. And I'm sure that there's some hospital testing regulation that some poor guy got like meningitis because somebody did a improper testing protocol and his family got a bill passed. And, you know, now we have to wait for some Washington bureaucrat to approve a testing protocol that a team of scientists in Washington want to go ahead with. Why don't we let the scientists do it?
To your point, you gave me an idea in what you just said, because you talked about the AR-14. And, you know, I think that, you know, it's nice when you can send out an olive branch to your enemies or opponents in the political process. I think we ought to right now, Scott, right here on the uprising, this moment, offer as an olive branch that we would be willing to accept a ban on AR-14.
Yeah, right.
What do you think?
All right. We said we weren't going to talk about guns, Tim. You're not the gun control correspondent.
I know. You're right. Sorry. My bad.
The point of that all is that government is part of the problem as to why we are here now. And I always want to make the point that there's this impetus in the country right now, and we see it, I think, from the legacy media more than ever and in a constant level, and just from all over as well, that we need the hand of big government to help us. What's Trump doing? What's he not doing? Well, certainly in terms of some travel restrictions and things like that, it's helpful to have the government on board. But just like, Tim, you see these million stories about the run on toilet paper, right? Like, apparently there's no toilet paper left in the country on, like, the supermarket shelves. Everybody's going for it. Well,
yeah,
who's going to produce more toilet paper? What's a better way to get toilet paper on the shelves of supermarkets? For the government to say we're going to have an office of TP acquisition and distribution? Or for the...
Yeah, that's a great idea.
The marketplace... Yeah. To understand that there is a great demand for toilet paper and respond to the demand, right? And there's two ways.
You know what, Scott? Really, all you need to do to prove your point is to show the old contrast left-right Soviet Union, United States, supermarkets in the Soviet Union, supermarkets in the United States. Empty shelves, shelves brimming with so many products you can hardly pick between them, right?
Yes,
it's the really, there's the market.
How many different types of tuna fish in cans do you think you can buy in Venezuela at, like, the local store? You know, there's two dozen over here.
Well, I think you're lucky if you can get bathroom tissue.
Well, there you go.
I mean, that's a luxury.
Oh, that's the first thing they went.
Venezuela now.
I don't know if you remember the stories, but when things got tight there, that was one of the first things that went.
I remember. I well remember.
So Liberty Nation writer Lorraine Silvitz has a friend who lives in China who sent her this message in Shanghai, a city of 27 million people. Quote, we are 500 miles from Wuhan, yet the number of cases of COVID-19 in Shanghai has never topped 350. Now, I'll put a caveat in that and say the Chinese numbers are not reliable, but let's say it's even 10x of that or 100x. It's still for a city of 27 million. Why? Quote, social isolation. Voluntary and enforced. Seriously, this is what you have to do. American states and cities are already closing things too late, but you can take care of yourself and others simply by staying home. It's really that simple. The frequent hand washing when you have to go out occasionally is not fun, but one adapts and it's fine. I have been astonished by the cooperative behavior of my Chinese hosts. I walk 10 miles almost every day, wearing a mask and for the most part through empty streets. And of course, to have to go buy food. Virtually every person I've seen wears masks and behaves as you would hope one would in the situation. Nobody argues, nobody protests, nobody proclaims their independence to do what they want and how they want. Nobody hoards. They behave in a manner that protects others and themselves. But the point is, the writer of this, who an American professor who's in China, says these are all voluntary measures, Tim, even in one of the most totalitarian societies on this earth. The writer's not saying this is what the government's making us do. This is what civil society, voluntary action between people can make happen. And that's sort of the point of the uprising. And I think the point for me, Tim, of Liberty Nation, and it's all very really coagulating here on this Wuhan issue. We cannot let government seize power because of the threat of this virus. Sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
I think that the government's role here is to instruct people exactly as you said, that they control their own fate simply by staying home and washing their hands. I mean, that's really about it, Scott. And, you know, the government's role here should be to make sure that people that need to be treated, you know, don't have barriers up to them, but to the normal person who's living with uncertainty, if not fear, just the simple admonition, keep your hands clean. Surfaces can stay infected for a long time, so overwash and just stay home as much as you possibly can. And I think these leagues, you know, the domino effect is in full force now after the NBA suspended their season, which is just a shocking headline to see. And now all the other sports have followed suit. To me, the most shocking of all was the cancellation of the NCAA basketball tournament, because that's such a cultural high point for so many people in this country. So many colleges, you think about all the players, but beyond that, the students who are big fans and all the boosters and all the fans and all the people who watch across the country and wait for March Madness every year. And now it's just canceled. And it's the weirdest thing I've seen in sports since the cancellation of the 1994 World Series, which most people thought could never happen.
Well, that brings us, Tim, I think, to another interesting issue. I was talking with Lisa K. Donner earlier today, and she was trying to get a handle on sort of the legal atmosphere regarding some of this. And before I'm going to actually interrupt myself and say, before I get into that part of the discussion, I just want to say, because undoubtedly there will be questions, that when the President of the United States invokes a state of emergency, unlike many other countries in the world, that does not affect your and my constitutional rights. There is no provision in the Constitution that says, for instance, we have freedom of assembly, but not if the president declares a national emergency. We still have the right to assemble. We still have the right to free speech. We have our guns. And as a matter of fact, Tim, I would say, and Lord, I hope that the founders would agree with me, that that's when we need them the most, when the government, quote unquote, establishes a state of emergency. And there are many dictators around the world who use emergency declarations in order to just exercise dominion and control.
Absolutely. Now, here's a teachable moment, which I want you to take up, Scott, and that is the difference between the declaration of a national emergency and the declaration of martial law, which is probably the worst fear of people that think an emergency declared by this president is the same as one declared by Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela.
Yeah, well, we do not have a martial law. It's sort of like when I love it when these Democrats, like, oftentimes will say, like, maybe I should correct myself. Not just Democrats. Maybe I need to be more narrow in my criticism, Tim. Some of these progressive, never Trumper, Trump derangement syndrome types are like, Trump's just going to cancel the elections. Like, what are you talking about? How does he cancel the elections? There's no ability or mechanism for which he can cancel elections.
He's going to cancel the election. I thought the thing was that he was going to lose the election and then refuse to leave the White House.
So there is no provision for martial law in United States constitutional governance. That doesn't exist.
You never saw the movie 7 Days in May with Burt Lancaster,
I don't think so.
Certainly you need to watch that before you make such a sweeping
statement. Was he married to Liz Taylor or something like that?
No, that was Richard Burton.
Oh, okay. Well, same difference
close
to me.
Those two were married like four separate times, I think.
Well, then that takes off our tally. I don't think you have to add them all.
Don't ask why.
So there is no such provision for martial law. I just want to say that most of this national emergency stuff concerns spending provisions and other. When Congress passes a law, they often will include a caveat or provision in the law that says, in the event of a national emergency, these funds can be diverted, these troops can be diverted, this whatever can be changed. And so that it's a triggering mechanism for then to have the executive do all sorts of other things. But none of those things can discriminate against our constitutional rights. That's not a possibility. Legally, that's not a possibility.
I think people ought to step back and think about what happens after a destructive hurricane. The president declares an emergency, and that just simply releases the spigot on federal funds to a particular place, in this case for a particular purpose. That's really all that it is. But I want to step back for a second while I think of it on something that you said earlier, which of course is in many ways true, which is that this is such a moving target and it's moving so fast. But I have a feeling that right about now, we've sort of settled into where we're going to be for a while. Now, we'll get other reports of people getting the virus. We'll get reports of people dying. We'll get reports of people being sick. We'll get reports of famous people getting the virus, all of that. But I think that we're now sort of resigned to the idea that this stuff's going to happen. We're resigned to the fact that our favorite sports are shut down, that we have to be careful when we go out, that there is a threat that we don't know that much about. I think we're almost at a point where we've culturally and emotionally as a nation sort of reached a level, and now the big challenge is trying to adjust to having to spend a lot more time with yourself and your family. to be honest with you. I think collectively it's going to be really interesting to see how the nation responds to, hitting the pause button.
You know, Tim, I went to the pharmacy today. And for those uprising listeners that have noticed the voice, it's not the coronavirus. It's strep throat for me. And, we play hurt here at LN. So you're still getting your uprising. But I went to get some medicine, which did work pretty well. But I wore latex gloves when I went to the pharmacy because I knew that when I checked out, I was going to have to interact with that checkout thing that everybody touches. And I just didn't want to. I mean, even just for the common cold or the flu, it's totally, unless you have the Purell right there, you don't want to be touching that thing. It is a pharmacy.
Well,
that's where sick people go to get their drugs, too. So it's like a double whammy.
I think the point, to accentuate the point I was making before, is that I think we have reached a point of almost settling into a consciousness of coronavirus.
Oh, well, so let me interrupt story, you. No, Tim. I'm disagreeing because while I had my gloves on, the other patrons did not have their gloves on, and I saw them touching the screen and then not, and then just going about their day, touching other things, their phone, their keys, and so I did not have that sense.
But I think, though, that, people like that, they're stragglers, they're latecomers, I think. Because I can tell you earlier in the week, I consider myself to be absolutely average when it comes to being paranoid about things. And when I went to an ATM a couple of days ago, I didn't think about it when I was pressing the buttons and I walked away with the cash. And I'm like, oh my, I didn't think about that. I shouldn't have done that. And then I'm thinking about the cash in my hands. Think about cash.
Cash is filthy.
How many hands those?
Yeah.
It's filthy. It's the filthiest thing because it goes through who knows how many hands.
Send it. By the way, send yours, listeners at home, to...
we'll inspect it for you. We'll do a thorough inspection and send you back a good, what do you say, 50 cents on the
Dollar? One of the very good podcasts out there that I talk about from time to time is the No Agenda Show. And they'll occasionally say, like... write your complaint on the back of a $20 bill and send it in to one of the jokes.
Good.
You know,
I'm gonna steal that idea.
Yeah. Well, one of the this is a good segue. I stole a clip from the No Agenda Show this week because, let's listen. This is former presidential candidate Yang on Anderson Cooper.
Nothing makes you appreciate a functional government like a global pandemic.
Right.
yes, I've always said that.
Yeah, no.
No, you're right.
But, I mean, none of us, there's very few people who have seen what happens when a society has the potential to really burst at the seams.
Yes. Biden's argument has been about sort of a return to moral normalcy, but it's also going to begin to look like a return to competence because Republicans have been running the government in sort of an anti-government frame, which is not what you want when you're dealing with a health crisis. And we all know when Joe becomes our president, he's going to bring back many of the Obama alums who are really, really competent and technocratic. And
that,
there's going to be real hunger for that in the days to come among many, many Americans.
The notion that, by the way, Barack Obama would somehow be way ahead of this thing, I think, is a bit rich. Now, it's true that Trump, in the early years of his administration, did dismantle some of the epidemic response team that had been set up in the federal government. But as I understand it, and I'm still researching this, I was sent an article by another Uprising listener asking for comment about it. It seems like it was not a decision to dismantle it just for the sake of it, but because it had been administered or implemented because of the Ebola crisis. And in the wake of that crisis abating, that's why it was dismantled. But I'm still looking at that. But I think that the reason why that's an important clip, Tim, is that Andrew Yang thinks that it's an anti-government administration, and that's bad in the face of a crisis. And I'll just keep making the same point. It's not bad because when you give power to the government, you take it away from the people. Government doesn't invent power and then use it. It takes power or is given power from the people or by the people. And I just want to try to convince everybody. I know this is I feel like a little Don Quixote-ish, but like, do not give the government power in a crisis because two things will happen. Number one, the government will not be able to protect you using the power that you've given it, because that's not the way government works. And two, you will not, very much likely, you will not get that power back. It's gonna keep it.
They take it and they never. It's always a one way process. Is what I call it. It's like Ronald Reagan once said that the closest thing to eternal life on Earth is a government agency, and it applies also to any time that the government seizes more power. Now, you know, let's put this in perspective. You know that back in 2017, were you aware that 60,000 Americans died from the flu in 2017? We've had, 40 at last count. I'm sure it'll change by the time this goes up on the web, but 30, 40 deaths from this. People are taking precautions. You know what? If the leftists want to expend every ounce of energy to try and reestablish more federal power and bring back those Obama bureaucrats that he's talking about, well, let's see what the American people think of that when this thing teeters out in two or three months. And how are they going to feel then when this, if this doesn't carry through to November and hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of people don't die, what are they going to say then?
Tim, the Obama administration couldn't develop a website portal to allow people to sign up for health care. I mean, forget about actually delivering health care or managing a pandemic, which, of course, again, this is the sort of, am I going to be a broken record on this podcast? Tell me where in the Constitution it says the government's going to be our daddy doctor and protect us from all this stuff. You know, some sound policies are great, maybe closing the border, great, but these other things that they're going to manage our lives in order to save us, we are...
How about a little perspective, Scott? I mean, in addition to the idea that nobody even blinked when we lost 60,000 people 3 years ago in this with just the regular flu, you know, the normal flu or the type of flu that we get every winter, but the Ebola and the swine flu, both which occurred during Obama's terms, were far more deadly in terms of the percentage of people that died, far more deadly. Do you recall seeing any kind of similar panic or criticism of the administration of Barack Obama?
Certainly the answer to that question is no, but I don't know, Tim, on an epidemiological comparison, when we compare the transmission rates and the mortality rates of these diseases, of the COVID-19 versus those others, if that's a valid criticism. I'm not suggesting it's not. Hey, I'm always up for criticizing Barack Hussein Obama. I just don't know that it's a valid one here.
Let me just say that it might turn out to be valid.
Oh, but it's not yet. Gotcha.
Scott. The point is, we're looking at, you know, what the media wants to do is look at worst case scenarios. Everything is, look, every time there's a hurricane, they're talking about, I remember being in the path of Irma, right dead center on the path of Irma.
Tell me
right
which
where
one
I'm
that?
Sitting right
oh, okay.
now.
Hey, Tim. Tim. We do not reveal the location of Studio C, please, to the people. That's a violation.
Well, I just said I was in the path. Now,
that
could have been several different locations.
Let's not dial it in.
Here's the point that, you know, the media always trumpets the worst case scenario, and I don't really want to think that the media is only concerned with cashing in with high ratings because of the sensationalism of all this. But when you see the way they're handling it and how they're just assuming that what you said, which is that, you know, there's going to be tens of thousands of more deaths and Americans are going to be infected far and wide and the stock market will crash forever. I mean, these things they're possible. Yes, it's possible. But we're way, way before the point where we could even say that's a live possibility, because it's been, I think we're in a, I get a sense that we're in a place of pretty good containment now, because everybody's aware of it. And those who aren't will be very soon.
I find that statement that you just made to be wildly, is it insulting to say Pollyannish? Because I don't want to be insulting. I want to say off base in a marked fashion.
In what sense?
That we are now, you know, just like I said, I was at the store and I see these people touching their screens and they're touching their phones and they're touching their faces.
Right, they'll come along, though. They'll come along.
Well,
I mean, look, it's still new, Scott. Just in the last week, things have changed so much. But the point is there's also the peer pressure now of people like you who... Today you observed it. Next week you might see the same thing and turn to those people and say, you know, it's not a good idea to do that with what's going around. And then, you know what I mean? The peer pressure, if nothing else, will get people to do the most basic things, which is stay home and wash.
I don't think
hands.
That's a danger for next week, because there won't be any anything in the shelves to buy. I went to get this medication, and the shelves are like, I mean, it looks like
Well, that's a panic.
It does look like
that's a panic. Yeah. Like they're going to close down stores as well.
I have to admit, I made a panic buy of a chub pack of paper towels at the Costco yesterday, just because it was such a frenzy. Everybody, I was like,
full on.
I was
panicked.
I was caught up in it.
I mean, I'm trying to figure out here where people think that having a supply of bananas and toilet paper and cottage cheese and stuff like that is going to be impossible because there's a virus going around.
Well,
I can't make that connection, Scott.
Cottage cheese is not something I'm worried about seeing ever again, Tim, but the other thing, certainly, for sure. All right, let me...
But, I mean, there's one of the industries. For example, I mean, Liberty Nation's going to do great in this, Scott, because more people are going to be home and they're going to be on their computers more, reading more. Supermarkets are going to do great because of panic buying, just like you described. So there's going to be some businesses that do really well, while others obviously suffer.
You know, I think that besides the... I'm glad you made that point. Besides, Tim, the infected persons, of course, and the to the extent that if you're in an area where the hospitals and the medical services are getting crushed with the burden of it all, those folks and the caregivers. But besides that, I think I have it worst of all. And the reason why, Tim, is because for the past, I don't know, couple of years now, I've been working mostly at home. And these other people have off for a couple weeks. I don't get off. Nobody says to me, just go ahead and don't do your job for a couple weeks. So I got to make the uprising. I got to write articles. So really the biggest victims here, and I want people to reach out and support those, are people who do work at home and don't get a break because of this
But you want to put up a GoFundMe campaign?
Well, you said it, Tim. I don't think it's
victims.
I think it's
home,
a little vulgar, you know? If I did it for myself, but if you wanted or others were motivated.
Related to your point, almost from the opposite angle, Scott, about this business about people working at home, I'm thinking about how we haven't seen anything like this except probably 9/11 in terms of an unexpected event, something people couldn't have anticipated, didn't know how to respond to, hadn't seen before, didn't know where to go, what to do. But think about if this had happened, say, 30 years ago, where we didn't have the internet, we didn't have computers, essentially, except big corporations, whatever. And think of the lost commerce, think of the lost economy that we would have, an economy which now can be largely propped up by people being able to be productive working at home. You can now do so much of what you do at work at home. Now, of course, industrial operations, things like that, you can't do that.
Not but sophisticated podcasts with excellent audio, Tim. That's a little bit beyond the reach of a lot of folks. Let's not encourage that kind of output, all right?
Oh, my bad.
Right.
Pretend I never said that. That was just between you and me. I don't think the listeners were paying any attention.
I think we are going to see a societal change, though. I think a lot of businesses are going to realize, you know what? I got the same work out of Joe when he was home as I did when he was here. And you know what I don't have to do? I don't have to pay to heat or cool his environment. I don't have to pay for, all these other things that are associated.
And he doesn't have to come into work and commute every
day.
And have to sit here and act the way that we tell him he has to act instead of being at home as long as he gets his work done.
You don't care how he looks or how he smells at home, right? Yeah, we don't have to have those awkward HR meetings about correcting his behavior.
I've often said that to you about your
Archie, the podcasting dog, is animated at this kind of discussion.
Yeah, he likes this.
He favors. He doesn't
this is
like
an opening for him.
Yeah, there's so many.
There's a big
so many restrictions on his behavior in the workplace.
I'm going to have to tell my pooch Bentley the same thing. He wants to make sure that I don't change the work environment too much.
Tim, you don't have to introduce Bentley like that. The Uprising audience is familiar with Bentley, the Sometimes Podcasting.
He's the substitute podcast dog, but he's not trademarked. He's not yet trademarked as dog.
Well, in the spirit of say something nice, it's good to say something nice about one's opponents or whatever. Gavin Newsom actually said something kind of nice about Donald Trump, I guess you could say, right? It's sort of a big surprise, and in the spirit of...
surprise? How about
shock?
How about head sewn to the carpet?
Gird your loins, clutch your pearls.
Head sewn to the carpet.
California Governor Gavin Newsom.
Yeah, we had a private conversation, but he said we're going to do the right thing, and you have my support, all of our support, logistically and otherwise. So before he made those statements publicly, I had a private conversation with him around 4:30 West Coast time, and he said everything that I could have hoped for. And we had a very long conversation. And every single thing he said, they followed through on. So I'm just not interested in finding daylight on those statements, because every single thing his administration, and it starts at the top, including the vice president.
You know, Scott, that's the kind of statement you would have normally expected a politician, even of the other party, to make about a president during a time of a public health crisis. In this case, it's an extraordinary head-shaking moment, like, wow, a left-wing Democrat actually said something good about Trump. I don't remember there wasn't a last time. So this was a head sewn to the carpet moment, and good for him, you know, to be secure enough in his own political identity, apparently, to say, look, this president promised what he promised, and he delivered it all. And good for him. I think it's a pretty simple proposition, but one that's just impossible, it seems, for any other Democrats to do.
I was talking to a relation who does not listen, I believe, to The Uprising, because she is a hardcore Democrat. And she was talking about how she was talking about the government response and very critical of it and hanging that all on Trump. And I'm happy to be critical of the government response. But how then is that an advertisement for more government is what I don't understand. Some of the FDA and CDC stuff that we're talking about with like the testing protocols, the idea that those decisions were brought to Donald Trump and he said, oh no, don't allow that, I think is a bit fantastic and ridiculous. It's these government bureaucrats who, and I'm not blaming Obama or W in particular, it's all of them who have come before today that have set up this system, right? But to me, the answer is yes, government screws up. What does that mean? You know what you can't do, Tim? And this is an argument that libertarians make time and time again. You can't choose in a marketplace when government's there. I can't choose, you know, if the DMV does a horrible job processing my paperwork, I can't go to a different DMV. If I can go to a different testing lab, though, if I want to get a coronavirus test, okay? And if they're, by the way, I'm not saying I actually can. If it were a free market, though, if they were allowed to be free and develop their own coronavirus testing without getting a first waiver from the government, I can say, well, maybe there's a trade-off, Tim, between invasiveness and cost. Maybe like the blood test is cheap, but the nasal swab is less, and I can choose. Maybe I want to only go to a place where there's a drive-through test. Whatever it might be, let the market provide for that. And a government, let me just finish on this one point again, and I hate to keep making it, but the government failure to do it is not a recipe or need for more government. It's a need and recipe for less government in our lives. That's where we'll get a benefit.
Well, good for you for raising the flag for liberty in the midst of a crisis, which is, as you've often pointed out, that's the crisis, the Leviathan. That's when the government builds its power, by convincing people that there's no other path to safety other than expanding government power. But I would be interested to see, based on what you said, if we were in a situation where you had a government-provided product and a privately-provided product, and both were available to the public, and let's say they were roughly comparable, let's say a testing kit, which one most people would buy? The privately produced one
Tim, I think really is a good thing to circle back around to my point I was making when I interrupted myself. And I was talking about my earlier conversation with Lisa K. Donner. We were talking about the tort laws in this country. And one of the reasons why so many things are canceled, Tim, is because if you're an attorney for like a performing arts venue, okay, right, and the president of the performing arts venue calls you up and says, hi, attorney, can you tell me what we should be doing regarding this coronavirus thing? Are we okay? Should we cancel our activities going forward or not? I have to say, I don't know if we're liable or not if somebody gets the coronavirus here, because this will only be determined in retrospect whether our actions are reasonable or not, whether the courts will view our actions as reasonable. So if you have a performance scheduled tonight for whatever, you have a duty to your customers, you have a duty to your client, your employees and the performer themselves to behave reasonably. well, what is reasonable in the face of this crisis has yet to be determined by the courts. So if you're a prudent attorney, you have to say to your client, well, I don't know how much you're going to lose for canceling all these tickets, but if a half a dozen people or more get coronavirus and you have to pay them out hundreds of thousands of dollars each, that's probably way more than the cost of the show we're going to cancel. So it's a prudent move then to just cancel everything.
Well, yeah. So what you've just done is condemn your own industry.
Yeah. Now, maybe that actually the is lawyers, the medically the, prudent well, thing, but I don't know. And, you know, we're...
Well, we know that that batteries of lawyers are going to be descending on who knows how many industries when this all, when the dust clears and this pandemic has been, you know, has passed. There's going to be lawyers all over the place. And
oh yeah,
and this is, and you're right. I mean, this is why. I mean, any individual, think about any individual fan. Let's say they're going to the NCAA basketball tournament. They go to the first round game. They come out of there. They test positive for the coronavirus. They sue the university. They sue the NCAA. They sue the arena. They sue everyone in sight. By some ambulance chaser who sees an opportunity, and we don't, and there's so much we don't know about the virus. Again, that's the point we have to keep making. It may be awful as some people think. It may be a lot less awful than people think. The point is that we don't know, but lawyers will pounce on that uncertainty, if not now, in the future. So I do understand in the litigious society that we live in why these, you know, these big sports leagues and the NCAA have decided it's just not worth it.
Which of the baseball, now for those of the maybe new listeners to the Uprising don't know that Tim has unfortunately been infected with the baseball bug since he was a very young man. Which of the teams is most disappointed by the cancellations because they were fixing to have a great year this year? And which is like, woohoo, we got another rebuilding phase ahead of us without penalty?
Well, actually, it's an interesting question because it depends on whether the season starts 30 days late or 60 days late or whether the whole season's canceled. If it's canceled, every team that decided they weren't going to spend any money because they couldn't be competitive anyway is going to sigh a deep breath of relief. Actually, to be honest with you, the team that almost benefits the most is my team, the Mets, because they have about three key players who were injured but will be ready by about May.
Well, we know that you and Mets owner Bill Maher will be delighted
with
that. All right, I've got Bill one Maher, more.
Right. The guy owns like 0.1%
hey, listen,
of the team.
That's your
Thank
that's.
You.
He's your guy.
Right?
You know what
go
I mean?
Ahead,
so the last windmill I just want to tilt at is price gouging. And it's one of these things where it does require two-step thinking, but price gouging helps everyone by appropriately valuing a scarce resource. And people can then treat that resource with the scarcity that it has. So if you're on, for instance, a barrier island and a hurricane is coming, Tim, and gasoline is $2 a gallon, and you need 10 gallons of gas to get to safety, but your tank takes 20, you're probably not going to restrict yourself just to the 10-gallon purchase. You're probably going to go for the full fill-up, because why wouldn't you? There's no information that's telling you you shouldn't. But if gasoline is $30 a gallon at that time, well, then you're going to be like, I need the 10 gallons. I'm not going to go, maybe I'll buy 11 just for a safety measure, but I won't go the full 20. And you know what that does? It does cost you a lot more money. But guess what? The other 9 gallons that are sitting in that tank in the station, they're going to be really helpful to the next guy that comes along that you didn't get the full 20. And it's actually to their benefit and society's benefit that price was increased. The information conveyed by the price increased. And by the way, you know who else it signals to, Tim? A guy sitting 100 miles away with a big tanker truck that he may want to move down and get that, you know, as fast as possible to get that fuel into the pumps so that more people can think. So those signals that the free market and pricing gives, and I'm talking now about dust masks and gloves, you know, these sorts of things that people are calling about price gouging on, probably toilet paper in a minute now, that's good. And it's a hard pill to swallow to learn that that's a good thing that's happening. But I think it's important to say because we're actually dependent on those price signals.
I experienced this kind of, I don't know, sensation. No, let me start
again. Yeah, you were saying in the path of Irma, you were referencing that again.
So, you know, Scott, I experienced what you were talking about when Irma hit back in 2017, and everybody was trying to get out of Florida. People were heading to the East Coast because they thought it would hit the West or the other way around. But in any case, people were trying to get out of the state, heading north. Gas was a problem, and hotels were a problem because there were a lot of people that had to stay somewhere. And I remember thinking the only chance I had was the fact that these hotels were gouging people. I was willing to pay, without even thinking about it, $300 for a $79 hotel room, or even, frankly, a $59 hotel room, because I figured there was a chance I could get one, because there was a lot of people that wouldn't be willing to do it. So it trimmed the supply, yeah, the same way you said. And it made for,
there's a perfect example. You and your wife have two boys. If you're traveling together, those four people might more comfortably occupy two separate hotel rooms rather than one shared hotel room. But if it's $500 for that room, maybe you only get one room for that one night and leave another room for another family to occupy. All right. Well, that's, I think we drilled down on that point quite well enough. And, we did not mention yet today's sponsor of the podcast, and we're doing it's going to be a little bit shorter show this week with the single subject, but you can find more material on this topic and others at libertynation.com. The sponsor for today's program, the written works there. We've got video products. We've got other podcasts, your radio show, Liberty Nation Radio, and that's what I want to talk about right now, because you give me such effusive and generous billing and introduction when I join you every week on Liberty Nation Radio. And if people don't get enough of the two of us, I'm on the show every week for 10 minutes or so, and they can listen there. But you call me the guardian of liberty, and I just want to close out this podcast by saying, right now, in this crisis, whether it's at the mayor's office or at the White House or Congress, everybody has to be the guardian of liberty, because it's during these crises when they will come for it and be most likely to be successful. So you guard it out there.
I mostly appreciate that you don't change your message based on whether there's some passing virus or passing threat or something, anything that provides power-hungry central planners to add another dimension of control to our lives.
Wash those hands. You know, one piece of advice that's actually, I think, maybe practical, Tim, and beneficial to people's health is, you know, they say that the virus particle is so small it can fit through one of those sort of common masks that are around. But the thing is, the virus particle doesn't travel by itself. It's usually on like a little piece of spittle or something like that that's coming in. And so it can stop that. So mask up, glove up, arm up, and fight the power.
Amen.